The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
People like Mr. Beast, people like Sidemen, you know, are the perfect targets because there is so much data out there. Understand that your digital appearance, sadly, is no longer under your control.
This week's episode of Unbox, I'm speaking with Henry Ider, an AI expert who is going to demystify AI for you over the next 30 to 45 minutes.
It's about not being scared of the tools, trying them out, experimenting with them, but then also critically understanding their limitations.
The biggest buzzword of our time, AI needs demystifying, and there's no better person to do so than Henry.
ChatGPT, the fastest growing consumer app of all time, now has 100 million weekly users. I mean, this is crazy.
We're going to talk about generative AI and the impact on daily work.
People using AI are going to replace people who aren't.
What would be your biggest piece of advice to a young entrepreneur starting out today?
My advice would probably be...
We're going to get into all of that today. So sit back, relax, and let's get into it with Henry. Henry, can you explain how AI and deepfakes are creating new opportunities for entrepreneurs today? And that was ChatGPT who suggested that one.
There you go.
A good way to start. So there we go.
You're making yourself redundant already, Jordan.
Yeah, which is the purpose of this podcast right now.
So for entrepreneurs, obviously you've got a lot of different things that you're juggling typically. I mean, it's the kind of thing, right, where even in startups or for solo entrepreneurs, like job titles don't really exist, right? You're a marketer, you're in sales, you're in content creation, you're in comms, all of these different roles. And I guess what tools like ChatGPT or Bard or Claude from Anthropic, all of these different LLMs, large language models, can do is essentially act as almost your intern, which is the way I like to think about it, is that this is a tool which can provide sometimes some overconfident, you know, answers and responses, but
fundamentally, like
but ultimately is something that can take away some of the work that often is a bit more narrow, a bit more repetitive, a bit more the kind of tasks that you don't really want to do, but you need to do. And so, you know, whether that's kind of coming up with ideas, whether that's basically scanning documents and pulling out key information, whether that's helping you write pitches, emails, things like this, can be super, super useful. Also, if you're doing written content, if you're kind of writing blogs or if you're, you know, social media posts, it can be really, really good for helping you with, for example, changing the tone. If you're like, I want to try and target more of this audience, it can be really useful. This all comes though with that caveat, which is you wouldn't let the intern send something off without you having a look over it, right? And that's something that many people are doing, which kind of has mixed results. Sometimes you get away with it. Other times it will have confidently, you know, can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah.
It confidently bullshits, right? About something that it has, you know, not much awareness of or is hallucinating, you know, which is this term for when AI essentially makes up facts or case studies or events that have never happened. Mm-hmm. So it can be really useful as kind of a co-pilot, something that you offload certain tasks to. And, you know, I use it in my day-to-day life. But
what do you use out of interest?
I use it for, you know, when I'm writing sometimes, say, LinkedIn content, I will try and get a second set of eyes, so to speak, on it, because my background is quite academic. And that means that I write sometimes in some fairly kind of dry ways.
Paragraphs don't work on LinkedIn.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, how many more emojis does this bullet point need or something? Yeah. But I use it as, you know, yeah, second pair of eyes, essentially, kind of be like, what is the tone? Is this consistent with the audience I'm trying to reach? Or sometimes it will be, you know, can you summarize this article for me? Because as you know, the AI space is now so full of hype and there's so much content going out there, keeping up can be really difficult. But even when I use it to summarize, if I'm going to then take something from that summary, I have to go find it in the article, right? Mm. Because I don't want to cite something from the article that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But it is essentially, in some respects, a bit of a superpower that can really free up a lot of time and a lot of capacity. At the same time, you have to be aware of its limitations. And there have been some great cases of people not being aware of its limitations.
Do you have any kind of horror stories that come to mind?
Yeah, so not personally, but, you know, there are many, many accounts of this. I mean, obviously, there's this great stat, which was, you know, when the summer holidays broke, ChatGPT's usage went down by large amount. And then when term started again, funnily enough, it went right back
if
up.
If I was at school with ChatGPT, could you imagine? I mean, well, people are living it right now. But for us, you've obviously long gone.
Yeah, yeah.
What a world that must be today.
Well, I have spoken to quite a few people in both kind of in schools and also people trying to build policy around education. And let's just say that there are a lot of teachers that are deeply concerned, right? Because as we'll probably get onto, deepfake detection and generative kind of content detection isn't very reliable at all. And so if you use them, you could accidentally say, well, you know, this is fake when it's not. But that then leaves them with like, well, okay, how do I essentially understand if this is by this person or not? Do I have to essentially kind of cross-examine them on their coursework, right? Or do I have to kind of look for, you know, language that they've used in other essays to see if it's consistent? Or, you know, one example that I heard the other day was, you know, most essays have spelling mistakes and so, or grammatical mistakes. Mm. And so if it's like perfect, syntactically perfect, then maybe that's another clue. But yeah, schools are really struggling with this. And yeah, I guess there have been some other cases, for example, of lawyers in court citing case law that doesn't exist in arguments. People citing like fake Guardian articles that don't exist. People using it in like contract writing, again, making clauses that make even no sense. And it's a kind of, it's almost an understandable problem if we look at the way that society has moved, right, is towards more convenience, less friction. We want to outsource. We want to just get stuff done. Attention spans are low and all of this. And so I can understand, even if it's not something I share, the temptation to just be like, I'll just ChatGPT it, right? But obviously people who then kind of give into that temptation, you're playing a lottery, essentially, as to whether you're going to get a pretty bad fuck up.
Yeah. But also, as you're saying, so much of that is around mindset, right? And actually, if you allow yourself to be tempted into like pure convenience to the point where you don't have to think, you will get subpar results, because obviously our brains are infinite. Well, they will be more creative, they will be more generative. That's how these platforms and programs get their information, is obviously through human input. And if we outsource that entirely, we're going to have worse results. But also, I guess the problem is, where does that end? Do you just outsource everything? Do you never think again? Like, where does this lead on a discipline level? Because most of us don't have the discipline to say no to the temptation of a free intern sat next to us all every day.
Yeah. So the critical thinking question is a really big one. It's a really interesting one, because again, I mean, if you go back to, let's say, the 50s, your grandparents' generation, for example, I mean, what the internet and digital media have done to society for them might look kind of dystopian on one level, right? You know, people don't pay attention to anything anymore. Look at all of this fake news that's now spreading that wasn't able to spread in the same way. You know, tools like Grammarly mean that no one ever has to actually learn how to spell anymore. It just gets fixed by a machine. No one actually intentionally listens to music anymore. They just let their Spotify autoplay just run all day, right? And so I think there's often this case of sort of, if you just go back generation by generation, there'll be things, you know, even for your parents' generation, that will look very strange about the behaviours now, which for us are commonplace, and the same for us looking at maybe Gen Z and whoever comes next. So sometimes it's difficult to kind of say, well, you know, if you'll indulge the philosophical term, an ethically normative statement, should this be the case, right? Should we be doing this? It's a difficult one. But there's no doubt that some people will be looking to offload essentially cognitive, you know, function to these systems. Why I think that that's probably not going to work very well in the long term is, well, this tool is now democratized. So obviously there are paid tiers to a lot of these. If you want to get like the pro versions of ChatGPT or Bard or Copilot from Microsoft, for example, you do have to pay. It's not an outrageous amount of money, but it's enough for most people to be like, do I want to spend, you know, £300 a year on access? But the base version is good enough that anyone who's got an email and a password can access it, right? And so when everyone can access it and everyone is kind of, you know, prompting similar kinds of, you know, questions or you know, or prompts, chances are that there will become a quite recognizable style to a lot of the kind of content that these models generate. And for me, there is still really a role for the kind of thinking outside the box, the kind of human creative context, subtle understanding of certain things, which will almost be impossible for you to even necessarily conceptualize and feed into a prompt, right? You know, so those kinds of things, I think there will be still a big role for human creativity if anything, I think it will become even more prized.
That's why I said that to someone earlier, actually, that the funny thing about AI is it's just shown the creatives from those who can ultimately be somewhat replaced by these tools, in that creatives have come up here because there are few and far between. In reality, a lot of people who are now feeling threatened don't actually maybe have the creative skills in creative businesses specifically. So let's say you're a video editor. Well, actually, how if the tools out there can do 70% of the base edit, you need to, your value is in the creativity. How much do you add to the edit? And if actually you're not very good, you get found out very quickly. No longer could you sit and just edit a video and that be your job, because there are tools out there who can do at least the line cut for you now. And I think that goes for a lot of different jobs now.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. There's a tool called Descript, which you might be familiar with. Right, okay, using it. Yeah. So, you know, that has very much that kind of automation of the parts of editing, which, to be frank, most editors don't, they're not like, oh, this is a really creative endeavor. It's kind of like, oh, I've got to, you know, crop here, cut here, align here, whatever. Same goes for filmmaking and for other kinds of editing in particular. You're familiar, I'm sure, with the Oscar-winning film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. In some of the scenes for that film, they used a piece of software called Runway, which is essentially, they pitched themselves as kind of like the AI tool for Hollywood. And there's a process in a lot of VFX where you essentially have to edit out things like pulleys, parts of the sort of the kind of rig that are enabling certain special effects. And they used this tool, Runway, to do a job in probably about 15 minutes, which would have previously taken maybe a day or at least, you know, a good number of hours. And for them, they're like, great, because that's not particularly creative.
And a huge cost saving as well, right?
Precisely. Mm. I mean, you know, tools that would have once been the dream of Hollywood studios are now truly available in like the palm of your hand on your smartphone or on your laptop. And so, as you said, I think there are a lot of kind of not particularly creative tasks that take place in creative industries where these tools are really having a big impact in efficiency savings. And as you said, if you're not editing in a certain way that's particularly interesting or stylistically distinct, yeah, you might get found out. At the same time, there are legitimate questions about, well, okay, an editor doing his job perfectly well might now lose his job, you know, because he's editing a kind of content which doesn't demand creativity. I mean, if you're creating a podcast for a platform like, or for a company, say, you know, a commercial kind of corporate podcast, let's say for a big accounting firm, they don't want loads of flourishes and aesthetic kind of elements, right? They just want a clean, well-edited, well-aligned podcast. Mm. And so those kinds of people might lose jobs, not because they're not doing their job as well as they can, but legitimately, you know, there are tools that can do it quicker and cheaper than they can.
Yeah.
And this is obviously across many different sectors in society and raises a lot of questions about how are we going to, both in the UK but also globally, ride this wave of disruption and make sure that there is essentially a safety net for people who are going to, redundant sounds too harsh when talking about people, but certainly are going to become less competitive in their role through no fault of their own.
Yeah, through this army of interns who come and upskill each individual by a factor of 10 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's some really interesting questions around this, right, in terms of liability, right? I mean, if you're, let's imagine you're a manager at a marketing company and you're in charge of managing product marketing for a certain, I don't know, brand of crisps, say. And your boss comes in one day and says, look, we're letting go everyone but one person in your team. There used to be five people, say, because we can now get you know, copywriting done using models which have been trained on all of our previous adverts. And we can generate kind of productized, stylized imagery for advertising and even video ideas and scripts and all of this stuff using models. So your new job is to basically childmind all of these models. But if any of them make a mistake, you're on the line. How many people are going to be kind of comfortable working in that way, where essentially they are sort of overseeing a set of machines which are known, you know, more than just occasionally to make mistakes? And the idea that if they kind of miss something, when the idea would be by doing this, you can churn out more content and the volume increases, how comfortable are they going to be with that? So, you know, I can understand why a lot of companies are excited about this. There are legitimate efficiency savings. There are new kinds of content creation that are enabled. But I think it's really important to remember that the heart of business and indeed consumers are humans. You know, there is in certain sectors still a value to the handmade, right? If I gave you something which looked identical, let's say I gave you a mug, which was, you know, really beautiful, nicely, you know, nice patterns, nice kind of fire and glazing, whatever. And I gave you an identical mug and I said, one of those has been created by an artisan in one of the other units at this place.
Yeah.
You know, they've got this backstory, they studied this, it's inspired by this. And I said, one of these was just an AI-generated design made in a mass-produced factory in China. I would like to think, at least for you, certainly for me, I would attach more value to one of those.
For sure.
And I think that goes the same even in the digital space. The idea that content is created by a person, by someone who is intentionally doing something, who is thinking, who is ideating on something. I still think there is value for that as humans for humans.
Yeah. So if I'm an 18-year-old today and I'm looking at the world, I'm, let's say, about to go to university or I'm finishing school, and over the last really like 2 years, AI has just become the dominant conversation in terms of the future, technology, upskilling, etc. What should I do? What should I be thinking about? How can I prepare myself?
Yeah, that's a really good and difficult question. And if I'm honest, I'm quite glad that I'm not an 18-year-old now.
Same.
For many reasons, but particularly because of the AI situation. And this is, you know, mentioning here kind of like AI anxiety of people who believe their jobs that they've been trained for a while have been made redundant. There's a different kind of anxiety from young people who are like, well, okay, what jobs are going to even be left to start training for in the first place? Mm. I think that kind of anxiety is maybe a little bit exaggerated. But for sure, I think they're growing up in a completely different landscape of resources and tools. If you were 18 at the dawn of, say, word processing on computers, you would have been thinking in a similar but different way about how these tools might be changing the landscape of how information is processed in organizations, how you share documents instead of, you know, faxing and writing on typewriters or whatever it might have been, you know, how that transition is going to take place. And I guess it's a similar situation here, right? New tools are emerging, which are going to change the workplace, which are going to change the kind of skill sets that employers are going to be looking for. And I guess one thing I would say, and it's a really cliched phrase, everyone is saying this, but there is truth to it, which is, you know, in my view, people using AI are going to replace people who aren't. It's not that AI on its own at the moment, although we'll come back to that maybe in terms of the future, but at the moment, that's not going to be the situation where AI is just going to replace people whole cloth. But people who are using AI to make their, you know, their workflows more efficient, to produce better content, to produce more kinds of content, to parse or understand information more quickly, you know, those are the people who are going to get ahead. And you have seen, no doubt, Jordan, like the excitement from big businesses and companies about like investing in these tools for their own organizations, adopting it within their kind of own workforce is pretty high. So I think for these kinds of young people, my advice would probably be, don't be scared of these tools, play with them, understand them, understand what they can do, understand what they can't do. You know, get a sense of both the kind of strengths and the limitations of the tool sets. And when you're using them, and again, something we might come on to, transparency is key. So for me, I think the future of these kinds of tools is going to be one where we disclose their use, hopefully, not from a sense of like guilt or kind of like admitting that we've done something wrong, but just from a sense of, yeah, like this paragraph is like partially generated via ChatGPT, or I use ChatGPT to change the style of the phrasing on this sentence, or things like this, right? In the same way that if you're writing an essay, you reference your sources. So yeah, the bottom line for me would be sure to experiment. Enjoy the process of seeing what these tools can do, whether that's image generation tools, whether that's editing tools, whether that's language text generation tools, audio generation tools, video generation tools, all of these different kinds of generative models. Play with them, understand what they can do, and understand, well, okay, if you're passionate about film or if you're passionate about content creation, how can that take your work to the next level? And what are the things that it doesn't do well that you can then say, well, look, I use this in this way to make this more efficient and more effective, but I'm also really good at the things that it can't do well. Mm. That would be my broad advice.
That makes sense. And what are some of these tools? Like, if I'm, again, young, what should I be learning? What should I be upskilling in?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, it's a bit
of a fool's...
Big three, yeah. I mean, it's a fool's errand to try and predict, you know, the future if you're, you know, a 14, 15-year-old now and you're going to be looking to enter the workforce, maybe after university when you're 21, say. Mm. This space is moving so, so fast. I mean, my role for the last 6 years has been what I kind of talk as like an AI or deepfake cartographer. I've been creating kind of maps of this landscape. And recently it's felt like kind of doing cartography in a sandstorm, right? It's everything's shifting, everything's moving. You go to bed and the next day the landscape's completely changed. So with that caveat in mind that the landscape is shifting really fast, I think, as mentioned, getting familiar with the tools, embedding them into your workflows where appropriate is really, really crucial. I think obviously, as we've seen pretty clearly over the last few years, having some understanding of programming, some kind of understanding of how these tools function is really, really valuable. That's something I wish I had done in school, is had the opportunity to learn Python or something like this, right? And then I guess I would say understanding precisely of you, as you've done so well in your project, like understanding like new kinds of content formats, for example, or new products that are going to be emerging, needs that people maybe don't have, you know, right this moment, but kind of naturally emerge from the kind of landscape that we're seeing right now. So did anyone think they needed a large language model 2 years ago? No. But obviously now there are billions of dollars being invested there. Did people think that organizations would be looking for prompt engineers to help them understand how to get the best out of these models? No. I still think it's a bit of a buzzy job title that's probably not as prominent as some people think, but nonetheless, you get the idea. It's a very kind of, I guess, entrepreneurial mindset you have to adopt, right? Which is looking for those gaps, understanding where that leads to opportunities, and also where it leads to potentially avenues shutting down. And that's going to be key. But yeah, I kind of do this mapping, but I'm certainly not going to kind of say that I'm the expert on understanding every single avenue in the workplace that this is going to change, because it's just so big. And it's really changing every different aspect of society.
As YouTube content creators, people like the Sidemen, Mr. Beast, whoever, if you were to come into our office and say, right, guys, you're missing a trick with AI, what would be your advice to us? We create content at scale every week across multiple different channels. We have editors, we have creatives, etc. What would be your kind of your map to us?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's funny you mention Mr. Beast, and of course your boys are Sidemen. And if you'll excuse my slight aside, but both, you know, Mr. Beast has been targeted by deepfake scams of recent, where his likeness has been essentially synthetically replicated, selling like dodgy crypto schemes or getting people to sign up to essentially fraudulent activity. I guess one thing I'd say immediately to your guys is like, understand that your synthetic likeness in this age, your digital appearance, sadly, is no longer under your control as it was a few years ago. Any of your boys could be essentially have their voices cloned very easily, their image cloned very easily, you know, a video synthetically lip syncing from one of your podcasts or one of their videos, getting them to say something they've never said, whether that's a scam, whether that's something that's super defamatory and damaging to their reputation. You know, in some respects, people like Mr. Beast, people like Sidemen, you know, are the perfect targets because there is so much data out there. That'd probably be the first thing. But in terms of like, I guess, leveling up your game, there are a couple of avenues that I think are really exciting. One is accessibility. So obviously you guys record in English, and I imagine the majority of your audience are UK or US based, I'd imagine. Yep. But with these tools, there is the ability to basically clone your voice speaking a language that you don't speak, but retaining your accent, the way your voice sounds. And that, for me, is a really cool opportunity to reach new audiences whilst retaining the authenticity of kind of your voice and the way that you sound and perhaps the way that you pronounce words and things like this. And obviously, I think that's something that should be disclosed to the audience. You don't want to be fooling people into thinking that KSI can speak Lithuanian or something, right? But
you never know.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe he's been doing some interesting homework on the side. But you know, I think for me, that's a really cool way for audiences who might be used to using kind of poorly translated subtitles or stuff like this, and kind of making them feel much more, you know, catered to as an audience. So it's an opportunity both to kind of reinforce that relationship with existing audiences that might be already consuming your content in a way that isn't ideal, but also to open up that content to a whole new set of audiences around the world, which I think is really, really cool. I would also say that, you know, when it comes to the kind of content that you guys are creating, I think there's actually perhaps slightly less opportunities and other avenues than you might think. And the reason for that is that the brand that you've cultivated is one which is really about authenticity. It's about the character and the persona and the people, right, of the group. And for some people who are maybe a bit more kind of, let's say, plasticky, you could maybe say, well, look, you can create synthetic versions of your voice to advertise products for different brands, which means that you don't actually have to do anything. You just license your voice or your face to promote stuff. But that works with some people, but I don't think it would necessarily work with your guys. And I don't think that's something they'd necessarily want to do, right? And the same goes for kind of using, you know, LLMs large language models to maybe like generate scripted content or things like this. Like, part of the magic is the spontaneous interactions between, you know, the group. So I think I would say that there are definitely opportunities. I mean, you might be able to, for example, if you're looking for ideas for like content, you could say, hey, like, what are some interesting debate topics in this space? Or what are some fun video challenge ideas or something like this, right? If you're kind of just doing some brainstorming. But I think the magic of a lot of content, particularly in this day and age where everything is increasingly synthetic, is authenticity and real personalities and real people having real conversations and real banter and so on. So I would say, you know, as I said earlier, play with it, but understand the limitations. And limitations for someone who's writing copywriting for a pretty boring brand is not going to be the same as the limitations for you guys building content around authentic voices for people who really respect and have the sometimes parasocial relationship, but those kind of really strong bonds with those individuals as those individuals.
Yeah. Looking into 2024 now, what are your biggest predictions as this cartographer of AI? What do you think's coming?
Yeah. So I think something like, I heard this on, The Rest is Politics, which I sometimes listen to, popular politics podcast. I think it was something like 2 billion people are voting next year in democratic, you know, elections. Huge. The most people have ever voted, ever.
If they show up, right?
Sorry?
If they show up,
right? If they show up. Yeah, I guess 2 billion people are eligible to vote.
Yeah.
Good clarification. That is a huge amount of elections around the world. And one topic that I've been asked about consistently since 2018 has been, you know, are deepfakes going to start really disrupting democratic processes? Deepfakes, by which I mean kind of cloning voices, faces to say things people have never done or never said in malicious contexts, right? And that was typically around the US election. So like every midterm or presidential election, I get all of the media in the US kind of being like, is this going to be the one? And I'd often say, no, the opportunity cost is too high. Why would you spend all those resources generating something which ultimately isn't that good when you could just use more traditional forms of media manipulation to create lots more content, which is still pretty effective? That formula has fundamentally changed over the last couple of years. And the question of whether deepfakes can kind of disrupt democratic processes and kind of spread disinformation is not really hypothetical anymore. It's much more about, well, is this going to be a really intense impact, or is this going to be something where, yeah, there's some impact, but it's minimal? So a couple of examples. There was an election in Slovakia a couple of weeks ago where the pro-Russian candidate won that election, which was, you know, significant within the kind of European context. But the opposition candidate, who was very pro-EU, was targeted by synthetic clones of his voice, saying that, I think it was saying that, you know, we're going to rig the election. And this spread on Telegram, the messaging app, and, you know, a lot of people seem to have been fooled by that, thinking that was real. So arguably, we've already seen potentially an election that's been affected by this. We've also seen deepfakes of people like Joe Biden saying that trans people shouldn't have rights. This Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren saying Republicans shouldn't vote in it, shouldn't have the right to vote in the next election because that's a danger to society. More recently, we've had deepfakes of the Republican candidate, a senator for Florida, Ron DeSantis, saying he's dropping out of the presidential race because of his bad performance. Again, all fake. And they're of varying quality, but the direction of travel is getting better, right? And even in the UK, we saw a voice deepfake of Keir Starmer come out a couple of weeks ago, where he was essentially, you know, swearing at an assistant, or it appeared that he was swearing at an assistant. And it was presented as kind of like a hidden recording, right? So the media would really struggle to say, well, okay, we found the original recording of that press conference and the lips have been changed, right? These kinds of situations are a nightmare. They're really difficult to deal with. And so one of my big predictions is we are going to see some impact on potentially a UK election next year, definitely the US election next year, and many others around the world. And as I said, it's no longer a hypothetical threat. Another avenue, I think, is AI-generated video. It's going to get much better. We've seen massive improvements there. So being able to prompt certain videos. And there have been some really like surreal kind of creepy ones you might have seen of like Will Smith eating spaghetti and it's like some kind of like nightmarish stuff, yeah, right? It's really grim. Or of like a pizza commercial created by AI and it's just, again, it's like some fever dream, right? But again, the improvements, the kind of the challenges with video is kind of like spatio-temporal consistency, i.e. like tracking an object consistently across frames, across time, right? But I think we're going to see big improvements there. I also think we're going to see many more tools which are kind of multimodal, a phrase you might have heard in the context of large language models being able to like look at documents, not just generate text. So you can upload a PDF now to ChatGPT and say, find me the top line points on this which are related to remuneration, for example, and it'll just pull out all of that information. But I think we're going to start seeing a lot more in the way of kind of large language models maybe have like a voice module attached that can then generate really hyper-realistic speech, potentially in your voice, potentially in other people's voices, or just human-sounding realistic voices which are unattributed. Same goes for in the video space, you might be able to get audio-visual, not just visual content. And then I guess the final thing is a frontier, which maybe 2024 is a bit early, but is probably going to be the use of AI agents, moving from co-pilot to autopilot. So at the moment, you have to prompt into a model and then take that output and use it, right? So if you want to do copywriting, you have to say, generate me something like this, and then you have to put it into the blog post and then WordPress or whatever, and then post it and then do the social copy and all of that. AI agents, fundamentally, you set much more tasks. So you might say, for example, generate me a campaign that's going to increase audience retention in terms of viewing distance, viewing duration, sorry, on this on this video. And that might be the model helping to create the most engaging headline. It might be about understanding from a kind of like a plan how to like structure an episode in a really engaging way. It might be about the marketing copy that you then put out on socials, right? And so this idea of like almost setting an AI agent on its own kind of track and just letting it go. It's really, really interesting. A story came out yesterday about two AI agents that negotiated an entire contract. So
did
from
do
the,
well.
Well, that's a good question. I didn't
that's
get to read
that's
the contract.
That's a risky game, that is.
It certainly is. But it automates the entire process from essentially inputting the text to basically getting the document ready to sign. So technically, the only involvement that would be needed from the human is to sign the line.
Wow.
But obviously, you don't want that to be the only
human
interaction.
What am I signing? Yeah.
Yeah.
The robot doesn't have to go through with the contract.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, you know, I'm sure the Sidemen would be very unhappy if you got them a contract.
We would be fired. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
Rightly so.
Yeah, exactly. So obviously, you still want humans to read that. You still want them to have some input. But this is what I find really interesting. We were talking earlier about, you know, large language models generating these hallucinations and people taking them as real and just kind of sending them off or referencing or citing them. This like puts out on steroids. It's like you could get entire contracts generated and just sign them. And some people will do this.
It's not
really a question of if, it's when. And in many of these contexts, I think this sort of even greater outsourcing to AI without the kind of due respect for the limitations of those models could end really badly. But even if, for example, you're monitoring an AI agent that's doing this stuff, there's still the chance that it could, you know, in real time start posting stuff on social media, which you're like, you know, fuck, I didn't want it to say that. Like, oh my God, it's gone off on a crazy tangent. You know, it's kind of like the crazy example of like, well, how do you reduce car crash fatalities? And one way that you can do that is by destroying every car. You get zero. Right?
Yeah.
And so these are the kinds of logic that you've got to make sure that these models are aligned to avoid, right? It's like, well, how do you get the best engagement on a post? You know, say a load of racial slurs and you'll get loads of engagement.
No.
Not good engagement. So you've got to make sure that the models are aligned with
the nuance.
Exactly. And the values that you're kind of setting. So, but I think that's going to be, these models are, they're really not very good at the moment in most cases, but I think they're going to be the next big thing after the kind of generative hype cycle has died down a bit. It's going to be these agents you can set off and do and kind of let them to their own devices to do your bidding, so to speak.
Very good. Right, we've got a game in this box.
Right.
I have a number of cards.
Okay.
If you could please take out one of them, read what's on it, and tell me what comes to mind.
Ooh, okay, interesting. I like it. Ah, okay. So this is about OpenAI's new ChatGPT feature, and they've announced a platform for making custom ChatGPTs. So this was, I believe, announced at their Dev Day, which they had, I believe, on Monday.
Yeah.
Really, really interesting for a couple of reasons. So one is there's been a lot of discussion around this announcement. Just for your listeners, you know, they have basically announced that you can now start training your own custom models using the kind of ChatGPT infrastructure, so to speak. So at the moment, you kind of have the big model and you kind of prompt into that model and then it kind of just spits out the results, but it's not custom trained for you specifically. This is going to allow people to build their own specific models.
Sort of like an app store, right?
A little bit, yeah.
Where you can develop your own stuff, yeah.
Exactly. Some people have been saying that announcement has killed like thousands of startups. Yeah. That were building kind of bespoke large language models for different use cases, for different applications. And so there have been quite a few very sad sounding entrepreneurs on LinkedIn and Twitter saying, I've got nothing left. Which obviously is a shame, but at the same time, without wanting to sound kind of smug, and I you know, obviously feel for these people, it's not nice when your business is kind of swept from under your feet, but it was quite predictable. And it almost...
It's always one of the first questions you ask a founder is like, well, what if this person went and did it? What's the difference?
Right.
And it feels like everyone was running to the hype of everyone's throwing money at this space. Yeah. Let me just come up with something that seems unique. But in reality, it wasn't.
Exactly. And I mean, that's something that we haven't really touched on extensively. But the hype on generative AI right now is so, so just overwhelming.
Dumb. It's too dumb.
It's really dumb. And we saw, I mean, we've seen similar hype cycles around like NFTs, Web3, Metaverse, all of this stuff. I don't think it's quite the same level of hype because the actual utility... Well,
it's more tangible, isn't it? Exactly. And the money is more clearly trackable rather than being speculative. This is like real stuff. But with that comes everyone starting a company every second day. And then you wonder why so many go out of business.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's kind of like a market correction / consolidation in some respects, It's inevitable. We saw it with the dot-com bubble. We've seen it with crypto and these other spaces. As I said, I think if you're looking at like NFTs, crypto, hype was here. Current utility was like down here. Mm. Whereas with generative AI, it's probably here. There's still a lot of hype, but we're seeing it make material impact in a way that these other technologies weren't. But anyway, this announcement, I think, is really big for showing that OpenAI are really looking to try and kind of almost diversify and appeal to that more bespoke custom audience, which I think a lot of people want. But yeah, a lot of sad founders out there this week. That's a good one.
Next one, please.
Yeah, sure. With the rapid advancements of AI capabilities, there is growing concern about its impact on employment. Do you believe AI poses a significant threat to job security across various sectors? And if so, what measures can individuals and organizations take to safeguard their roles in the workforce? So we've kind of already spoken about this at the beginning, but I mean... As I said, that concern is widespread. There's this AI panic, AI anxiety. I think on some levels that is valid. We're seeing certain people in certain roles already having their kind of jobs impacted, whether that's in journalism, albeit to pretty poor effect for the people who are now outsourcing to models, copywriting, even illustration. There was a really big scandal in, I believe it was, I think it was either Japan or China, when backgrounds for anime, which were used to be hand-drawn, were being AI-generated. Same, I believe, with Fallout, the video game. They were using AI-generated content for that. And there is, as I mentioned, this kind of distinction between the handmade, like people wanting a human to be involved in that creative process and not. But if it makes sense for a company and they're going to get a huge amount of efficiency savings and they'll put up with some grumbling from the public for a little bit and then people get used to it, no doubt it's a problem. As mentioned, I think it's not about... You can't just put your head in the sand and say, no, I don't like this. I'm not going to adapt. You have to adapt. You have to understand how this is changing your industry. Doesn't matter whether you think it's for better or for worse. I mean, if you think it's so bad, obviously, then you have a really big existential challenge about changing your industry. But it's about not being scared of the tools, trying them out, experimenting with them, but then also critically understanding their limitations and not buying too much into the hype based on what people are projecting, speculating, saying it can be used for. Understanding yourself, this is really good for helping with this task. Sucks at helping with this task. This opens up new avenues here. It closes actually doors here. So I think that's the kind of approach I would take. But I do think inevitably there will be people through, as I said, no fault of their own, who are really good at what they do, but they just will not be able to keep up with automation. And we've seen that again throughout history with different contexts. So a time of disruption for many, but as I said, one that also I hope can be exciting for others.
And at least everyone has access to the tools in one way, shape or form. Whether or not you want to use them or not is up to you, but everyone largely has a smartphone, can get access to the internet, and therefore can go and actually use these tools themselves.
Exactly. I mean, when I talk about this to audiences who I'm trying to get to understand why this is a big deal, why this isn't just the same as, say, CGI or computational photography, as we've seen it before, I talk about three things: realism, efficiency, and accessibility. The biggest one is accessibility. ChatGPT, the fastest growing consumer app of all time, now has 100 million weekly users. I mean, this is crazy. And, you know, as I said, I've been mapping the space for a long time. These capabilities have been around in some form or another for a while. The difference is how you now access them and who can access them, which then leads to brand new use cases, the kind of collective learning of billions of people, means that we're now seeing weird, wonderful, and often also quite scary uses emerging in a way that was just not possible before. So, as you said, because they're so democratized now, on one level, there isn't really an excuse for not at least trying them out and you know, making a judgment yourself about whether they are suitable for what you're working on. But yeah, disruption guaranteed.
Love it.
This is the Elon Musk, Rishi Sunak conversation at the AI Safety Summit last week. I have some thoughts.
Yes.
So in general, the AI Safety Summit, for your listeners who may not be aware, was the UK organised this global summit at Bletchley Park, which is where Alan Turing did a lot of his work during World War II to crack the Enigma code, kind of the birthplace of kind of modern computing, I guess you could say. Even if, you know, Milton Keynes and Bletchley isn't perhaps the most glamorous location.
Yeah, which
but,
it definitely isn't, but...
Yeah, but fair enough. And this brought together world leaders to discuss some of the kind of the risks around AI and what they called frontier models, that is kind of the rapidly emerging kind of medium-term future for how AI is developing. And so they came to some agreements. They kind of signed a memorandum, I believe, around the kind of catastrophic risks that AI could pose if not developed responsibly. It was signed by, I believe, 28 countries. But also as part of this AI Safety Summit, which took place in London as well, Rishi Sunak hosted a conversation and interviewed Elon Musk. And I don't know if you saw it, Jordan?
Yeah, saw the clips.
Right, but I was a bit uncomfortable with the dynamic, which was that Rishi Sunak seemed very excited and very kind of chipper to be doing this interview, and seemed like there was a bit of the power balance was bizarre from the leader of a global country, the UK, with, okay, sure, the richest man on earth, but someone who, you know, I think should be treated perhaps a little bit more critically. The way that Sunak was asking him questions was almost like he was kind of an outside perspective, a commentator or someone who was a researcher looking in, as opposed to someone who has a horse in the game, right? He's got XAI, he's launched, they actually released their model on Sunday of this week.
Gonk.
Grok. Terrible name.
Yeah.
But, you know, so for me, was it a good thing to have him there for just kind of general presence? Sure. I mean, I have my thoughts on Elon Musk as a character and what he's done to Twitter. I'm refusing to call it X. But, you know, there's no doubt that his voice carries and that he is a player in the space. And it's important to have him involved in some capacity. But I was really uncomfortable with the way that essentially this pitted a politician as almost the kind of, you know, excitable interviewer of who is someone who is essentially a business
person.
Interesting.
But I also like... Yeah, that's an interesting perspective around, that there is a almost Rishi being intimidated by Elon Musk and him almost being like the sort of child in a man-child relationship. It was weird because he was the superstar on stage, but Rishi Sunak runs the UK. He's the prime minister of this country. So you're right. I didn't even think about that. That dynamic is off.
It was bizarre. I mean, for me, I would have rather they were both interviewed by a third person because then they would have been a little bit more... parity, a bit more you know, equity in terms of the way that their voices were treated. And it was interesting because, you know, this whole conference, you know, there were people saying this isn't going to steal jobs, this isn't going to, you know, or this isn't going to completely wipe out employment and stuff, and then Musk comes along and says, oh yeah, no one's going to need to work at all in the near future. So as I said, a powerful voice, a voice that whether you like him or not holds
carries weight.
Carries weight, exactly. But the format was bizarre.
Okay. No, thank you for that. And
no worries.
To close, what would be your biggest piece of advice in relation to AI to a young entrepreneur starting out today?
Yeah, so I work with quite a lot of startups and people who are kind of young entrepreneurs looking to build in the AI space particularly, but also with some entrepreneurs who have done incredibly well, who have now got unicorns or who are now running very successful companies. And the common thread amongst the ones who do really well is they typically don't follow and they don't kind of cow to the pressure of the hype. And I think that's one thing I'd say is, as we just spoke about, right, there are many, there are entrepreneurs out there who are licking their wounds this week after this announcement. And as I said, for me, at least personally, it was somewhat predictable that this would happen. What that means to me is, okay, if everyone's really excited about generative AI, maybe wonder, oh, okay, are people, you know, going a bit too far with this? Is the capabilities being overstated? Is this market getting too frothy? You know, is there an oversaturation? And then also understanding, like, is this actually generating value? Like a phrase that I use often is, novelty isn't revolution, right? Like, just because something is novel and new and different doesn't mean that it's fundamentally going to change anything in a kind of like a longer term sense. And a lot of these AI products, I think, are going to have a bit of a reckoning when people get over the novelty of using them and actually start thinking, okay, but what's the actual value beyond the, huh, that's neat. You know, what is the actual value that's being generated? So that's for AI specific founders. I guess for general founders, for general entrepreneurs who are looking at the future and thinking, what can I build in various different sectors to kind of, generate value for customers and you know, generate, you know, a business for me. I think it is all about understanding kind of the forces that are going to be shaping the next decade, say. And, you know, there are ways that you can build effective companies in very traditional molds and kind of just tweak, you know, a bit like when I was doing academic studies, you know, it's like a lot of the papers that were published were just like, this little bit here is sure about, right? And, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing that model. But I think if you're looking to try and build something that is really quite profound and really kind of has that potential to grow quite radically, it really is about looking at those trends, whether that's things to do with perhaps how quantum computing is potentially going to change things. That's a bit more longer term in terms of, you know, computational resources. But then also, for example, well, what does this mean for encryption, right? Whether that is AI in this current framework being like, okay, I mean, for you, one interesting space is virtual influencers. You know, I was talking earlier about the people loving your projects and the sidemen for those authentic voices. But in places like South Korea, there are entirely AI-generated characters. You might have heard of Lil Michaela as well, right? Like, completely AI-generated, millions of followers modeling with Bella Hadid, doing adverts for BMW, talking about her mental health, you know, as an AI-generated character, and it resonates with people. So understanding, like, how these technologies are fundamentally changing things, how they're opening up new markets, and how they're basically changing not just kind of business models, but also, like, value systems, about how society thinks about certain content, thinks about certain ways of communicating, buying, selling products. So that would be my rough advice. But I must say, I'm an entrepreneur in the sense that I advise big companies, I advise startups, I do speaking, I do lots of different things. I wear many different hats in my capacity as an expert on deepfakes and generative AI. But I don't have any employees and I'm not looking to build something mega. So
you don't need them when you got ChatGPT.
Yeah, there you go. I've got my army of interns.
That's it.
Army of interns waiting. And once the module is plugged in to give them a face and a voice.
Yeah. No turning back from then.
There we go. We're in a new world.
Amazing. Well, Henry, thank you so much for coming on, mate. That was incredible.
My pleasure. Really great to chat, John. Thanks for having me.
Okay, I'm a little bit less scared now. That is great. Thank you so much, Henry, for coming on the show. Hope everyone at home enjoyed this too and you're feeling a little bit less scared, or maybe more scared, I don't know, about AI and the impact on you and your job and the world of entrepreneurship at large. So thank you as ever for tuning in to Unbox. Make sure to like, comment, subscribe, share it with somebody who needs to hear this, and we'll see you again for another episode next week.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.